Right now, an engineer somewhere is using an AI model that practically rivals human intelligence to write complex software.
Yeah, it's wild.
And meanwhile, across the country, another developer is taking a socket wrench to the dashboard of his brand new Toyota, like physically ripping out its microchips just to get some privacy.
It is a pretty profound contradiction, honestly.
Right. Well, welcome to the deep dive. We have a massive stack of notes here from the May 15th, 2026 edition of Tech and AI Daily. And our mission for you today is to really figure out how our technology landscape is simultaneously accelerating to warp speed and completely falling apart at the exact same time.
I mean, the tools we're building right now are granting just unprecedented leverage, but they're also exposing these massive vulnerabilities in our infrastructure and honestly, fundamentally changing how the human brain processes information.
Yeah, it's a lot. Let's start with that acceleration part because next week is Google I/O and the leaks are already
Oh,
out.
yeah, they always are.
Exactly. So sources indicate Google is set to unveil a new Gemini model that lands in what they're calling the GPT 5.5 class.
Right.
It reportedly sits just below Claude Mythos in raw power, but it represents a really highly meaningful step up from their current offerings.
Well, and it shows we're kind of moving past the era of those massive, unpredictable quantum leaps in AI
Oh,
capabilities.
you mean like the jump from GPT 3 to 4?
Exactly. We've entered a phase of just relentless grinding iteration. Like landing in the GPT 5.5 class means the major cloud giants are fighting a war of inches now.
Right, it's not a whole new paradigm.
Exactly. It's about squeezing out marginal efficiency gains, refining logical reasoning,
Yeah.
not unveiling some entirely new concept of intelligence.
But okay, while Google and all the other giants battle over those inches in their massive data centers, there is this huge parallel movement happening on people's personal laptops.
The local AI scene, it's booming.
It really is. The notes highlight this great explainer on the GGUF file format. And for you listening, if you aren't deep into the open source AI scene, there are these tools out there like llama.cpp and Alama.
Right, which are game changers.
Yeah, I mean, llama.cpp is essentially a piece of software that lets you run heavy AI models on a standard laptop processor instead of needing like massive, expensive graphics card.
Yeah, you don't need a server farm anymore.
Right. And then Alama packages that up so it's as easy as downloading a normal app. But GGUF is the actual file format that makes all of this local AI possible.
And the reason GGUF is so critical, why everyone is talking about it, is that it's a completely self-contained package.
How so? Like, what was it before?
Well, previously, downloading an AI model meant downloading raw neural network weights, which is essentially just a massive spreadsheet of
It
numbers.
sounds intuitive.
Right. And you just had to hope your software knew how to process it. But a GGUF file includes all the necessary metadata. Crucially, it includes the tokenizer configuration, which is essentially the specific dictionary that that particular AI uses to chop up and understand human language.
Wait, okay, so it sounds a bit like a high-tech ZIP file.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
But instead of just holding an MP3 of a song, this file contains like the sheet music, the instruments, the tuning configs, and the exact instructions on how the band should play it. You
Exactly.
just double-click it, and the band starts playing right there on your machine.
Right, because it contains that sheet music,
Yeah.
the software doesn't have to guess. It reads the instructions and it just executes. This democratization means anyone with a decent laptop can download a model and have a localized, totally private AI running completely offline in minutes.
Which is amazing. But building these models in the first place, whether they're the giant cloud systems or the local GGUF files, it takes incredible human talent.
It does. It requires absolute top-tier engineers.
Right, and that brings us to the MIT president who just publicly sounded the alarm regarding severe cuts to federal research funding.
This is a huge deal.
They're warning that this threatens the fundamental talent pipeline feeding AI labs and downstream tech companies.
Yeah, and this gets to how we actually measure progress in the industry. Because right now, the obsession is entirely focused on benchmark
Oh,
leaderboards.
for sure. Everyone wants to know who scored highest on today's coding test or bar exam.
Exactly. But the MIT president is pointing at this invisible structural rock. Federal research funding is what pays for the PhD programs.
Right.
And those programs train the people who eventually go on to invent the next generation of AI architectures.
So it's kind of like cutting the funding for the metallurgy lab while everyone is in the grandstands cheering for the race car driver.
Yes, that is exactly it.
Like nobody notices the metal is weak today, but 5 years from now, when the car is doing 200 miles per hour, the axle just snaps.
If you cut that funding, It simply doesn't show up in a benchmark today. You won't see it. But in 5 years, the entire industry hits a wall because the foundational talent to solve the next major architectural bottleneck simply does not exist.
Man, well, while MIT is worrying about the people building the AI, there's a really serious conversation happening about the people using it.
Right, the developers themselves?
Yeah, yeah. The notes include this brutally honest developer essay going around right now, and it's titled, AI is making me dumb.
I read this. It's fascinating.
It's intense. The author describes this creeping cognitive atrophy. Like, after months of relying on tools like Claude and Copilot to write their code, they realized they were losing the physical ability to hold complex, multi-step problems in their head.
Well, yeah, they're outsourcing their working memory.
Exactly.
When you have an AI instantly writing all the boilerplate code and solving all the micrologic puzzles for you, your brain just stops exercising the mental muscle required to keep all the moving parts of a software architecture active in your workspace.
Okay, I have to push back here, though.
Go for it.
When I was a kid, teachers always said we had to learn long division because we wouldn't always have a calculator in our pocket.
Right, the classic argument.
Well, now I have a supercomputer in my pocket at all times. Is outsourcing our working memory to an AI fundamentally any different from outsourcing long division to a Paseo calculator? Like, is this just the panic of 2026?
I mean, I hear you, but it is fundamentally different.
How so?
A calculator handles rote execution. It frees you up to think about higher level math. But working memory isn't just a passive storage drive. It's the active cognitive workspace where synthesis actually happens.
Oh, I see.
If a software developer can no longer hold the architecture of a program in their head, they can't foresee how a change in module A will catastrophically break module B.
Because they can't see the whole board anymore.
Exactly. They lose the holistic understanding of the very system they are building.
And that loss of holistic understanding is terrifying, especially when you consider what they are building on top of.
The foundations are already shaky.
Right. If developers don't understand the system, they certainly aren't catching the foundational cracks underneath it. Which brings us to the Nginx exploit.
This is the bad one.
We just saw a critical exploit for Nginx published on GitHub by a security group called Depth First Disclosures.
Yeah, we really need to unpack what this means for any listener out there running web infrastructure.
Right.
Because this is not just a theoretical CVE.
And then a CVE is just the public record of a flaw, right?
Right. Common vulnerabilities and exposures. It's essentially a global dictionary of publicly known security flaws. And often, a CVE is published as a warning way before anyone has actually figured out how to use it maliciously.
Like a, hey, fix this eventually kind of thing.
Exactly. But this is different. There is working proof of concept code out in the wild for this right now. If you are running Nginx in production, you have to patch immediately.
And Nginx is what, one of the most widely used web servers on the planet?
Yes.
So for you listening, this isn't like finding a broken lock on one door in a sketchy neighborhood. This is the master key for half the apartment buildings on Earth getting pinned to a public bulletin board.
That's a very accurate, albeit terrifying, analogy.
The notes say this relies on a buffer overflow. Can you break down the mechanics of how that actually compromises a server? Like, what does that mean?
Sure. Imagine a bartender pouring a pint of beer, but they just don't stop pouring.
Okay.
The beer overflows the glass, spilling onto the counter, ruining the receipts, shorting out the cash register.
Chaos at the bar.
Complete chaos. In software, memory is allocated in specific containers called buffers.
Okay, the pint glass.
Right. If a program is given too much data, say a maliciously oversized web request, and it doesn't check the size, that data overflows its designated container. It spills over and overwrites adjacent memory instructions.
Wait, so it overwrites the actual instructions the computer is trying to run?
Exactly. And an attacker uses that spillover to slip in their own malicious commands, effectively taking control of the server.
Wow. And it isn't just the software layer failing us either. We literally cannot even trust the hardware.
No, we can't.
The notes detail the first public macOS kernel memory corruption exploit, and it's targeting Apple's brand new M5 chip.
Yep, the hardware itself is vulnerable.
But hold on, I thought Apple Silicon's entire selling point was its locked-down, ultra-secure architecture? Like, how does someone even reach the kernel of an M5 chip?
Well, Apple builds phenomenal chips, right?
Right.
But they're still bound by the laws of computer science.
Fair enough.
The kernel is the inner sanctum of the operating system. It has absolute privilege over everything the computer does. A kernel memory corruption happens when an attacker finds a flaw in how the physical chip itself handles memory translation. or they exploit speculative execution.
Which is what?
It's the predictive tricks the processor uses to speed up tasks. By manipulating those actual physical hardware quirks, an attacker bypasses the operating system's software protections entirely.
So an attacker manipulates the literal physical hardware to gain the highest possible level of software control.
Yes. It completely shatters the safety bubble surrounding Apple Silicon.
Wow.
Anyone listening who works on M5 hardware needs to be on high alert for emergency firmware patches, like today.
So we have web servers vulnerable to buffer overflows and brand new hardware chips getting exploited at the kernel level.
That's a mess.
The industry feels like it is desperately trying to patch a sinking ship, but some teams are deciding to just build an entirely new ship.
You're talking about Bun.
Yes. The Oven team, the developers behind the JavaScript runtime Bun, just made this massive architectural bet.
Oh, it's huge.
They merged a complete rewrite of Bun's core internals into their main branch, and they rewrote it entirely in Rust.
Right. And Rust is a programming language specifically designed to guarantee memory safety.
Which would stop the bartender from overpouring.
Exactly. Remember that Nginx buffer overflow we just discussed?
Mm-hmm.
That happens because traditional languages like C and C++ allow programs to accidentally mismanage memory. They let the bartender keep pouring.
Right.
Rust operates completely differently. It has this incredibly strict compiler system that checks the code before it is ever even allowed to run.
Okay, so it catches it early.
It mathematically enforces memory ownership rules. If your code has even the potential to cause a buffer overflow, the Rust compiler simply refuses to build the program. It won't let you do it.
But, I mean, rewriting an entire core foundation from scratch sounds like a great way to invent brand new bugs.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Like, they're betting everything on Rust for memory safety, but does a massive core rewrite like this actually solve the vulnerability issues, or does it just introduce a whole new mountain of chaotic churn for their users?
Well, in the short term, it absolutely introduces churn. There's no getting around that. Whenever you rewrite a complex system from scratch, you inevitably introduce regressions. Features that used to work perfectly will suddenly break.
Right. People are going to complain.
Oh, they already are.
Yeah.
But the Oven team knows this. They're making a long-term calculation. They're arguing that the underlying foundation of how we currently build systems in C and C++ is just so cracked that the temporary pain of a massive rewrite is worth it to reach a mathematically safer destination.
So it's like deciding your house has so much termite damage that you can't just keep painting over the walls.
Right.
You have to physically lift the house and pour a completely new concrete foundation.
Exactly. And fixing that code, pouring that new foundation, it takes years.
So what do governments and enterprises and frankly everyday people do in the meantime while they wait for this safe code?
They build walls.
Right. We are seeing a massive demand for sovereignty right now on both a global scale and a deeply personal one. Let's look at the macro level first. There's a factual report from Deutsche Welle confirming that German intelligence agencies are officially ditching US-based Palantir software.
Yeah, and if we look at this strictly through the lens of data sovereignty, it's a fascinating indicator of where the world is heading.
Tell me more.
Well, we're in an increasingly fractious geopolitical environment. Nations are realizing that routing their most sensitive intelligence data through foreign-owned proprietary platforms is a massive strategic vulnerability.
But how does dropping Palantir actually solve that? Like, what are they switching to? Do they just use nothing?
No, they're moving toward open source solutions and local infrastructure. This move by Germany, it's really a preview of enterprise and government procurement across all of Europe.
Okay, because with open source, you can actually see what's happening.
Exactly. If you use a proprietary closed system, you can't see the code.
Right.
You don't know exactly how the data is being routed or if there are back doors built in.
Right.
But if you use open source software, your own intelligence agencies can audit the code line by line. You can run it entirely on servers located within your own physical borders. You verify it and you lock it down.
That makes total sense. They're going on the offensive to build their own alternatives, which ties into this other note. Germany's sovereign tech fund just injected 1.3 million euros into the KDE desktop infrastructure.
Yeah, which is a huge shift.
Right. And KDE is a major open source desktop environment used heavily in Linux systems.
And you really have to notice the word sovereign in that fund's title. For decades, open source software has been treated by governments and corporations almost like a charity project.
Maintained by passionate volunteers in their free time.
Exactly. But Germany putting substantial money into KDE is a very meaningful signal.
Mm-hmm.
They are treating open source software as strategic national infrastructure now.
Because they have to.
Right. Because if you cannot inspect the code of the operating system your own government runs on, you do not actually own your infrastructure.
Wow. Okay, so that handles the intelligence agencies and the national governments. But how do you, the listener, take back control?
It's a lot harder for the individual.
It is. But on a digital level, there was a major update for the privacy-conscious folks this week. The second public OTOH relay just went live.
Yeah, oblivious DNS over HTTPS.
Right.
And to understand why this matters, we have to look at how the internet works at a really basic level. Every time you type a website name into your browser, your computer has to ask a DNS server to translate that name into a numerical IP address.
Okay, a phone book lookup.
Right. But historically, whoever runs that DNS server, which is usually your internet service provider, knows exactly what websites you're visiting. They have a full log.
Right. It's like handing the post office a transparent envelope. They can read everything inside it while they're delivering it.
Exactly.
Oh.
But OTOH changes that mechanism entirely.
Okay.
The oblivious part of the acronym is the key here. It separates the who from the what. It works by using a relay system.
Let me try to visualize this. It's like using a physical courier system.
Okay, go with that.
I give a locked box to Courier A. Courier A doesn't know what is inside the box, but they know I gave it to them.
Right.
They hand that box to Courier B. Courier B has the key to open the box to see where the package needs to go, but they have absolutely no idea who originally sent it.
That perfectly illustrates the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
The relay ensures that the server, knowing who is asking, doesn't know what they're asking for. And the server providing the answer doesn't know who asked. Because this new public relay requires no account to use, anonymous DNS resolution is now highly accessible for self-hosters or really anyone who simply wants to protect their daily browsing traffic from surveillance.
That is incredibly cool. That gives us a digital wall. But then the notes highlight the most extreme, frankly, incredible example of physical sovereignty.
Well, the RV4.
Yes. A developer documented themselves physically, surgically removing the cellular modem and GPS tracking hardware from a brand new 2024 Toyota RAV4 hybrid.
They literally took a wrench to it.
They tore the dashboard apart with a socket wrench and wire cutters just to disconnect the car from the grid.
The teardown documentation is meticulously detailed, too. And honestly, it highlights a grim reality about our hardware. Connected car privacy isn't just a theoretical debate anymore.
No, it's very real.
When you buy a modern vehicle, you are essentially buying a 2-ton smartphone. It constantly reports your location, your driving habits, your acceleration metrics, and even your synced phone contacts back to the manufacturer.
Which they then sell.
Exactly. So for a privacy-minded tinkerer, a physical teardown guide like this is incredibly valuable.
But think about the extreme of that. We have gone from nations dropping enterprise software contracts to a guy ripping the electronic guts out of his brand new car to stop it from tracking him.
It's wild.
If the ultimate privacy solution in 2026 requires wire cutters, has the whole smart device era officially become a liability for the consumer?
I mean, we were sold the idea that connectivity equals convenience. And to be fair, it does.
Sure.
But we are collectively realizing the price of that convenience is total unbroken surveillance. When the software layer fails us, when the privacy policies are too vague, or the digital opt-outs don't actually stop the data collection, people will resort to hardware-level solutions.
You have to physically break the connection.
Severing the physical antenna is the only way to mathematically guarantee a system is not transmitting your data.
It is wild to think about. As we start to wrap this up, can you pull these threads together for us?
Yeah, so what we're seeing across all these sources is the tension of the paradox we discussed at the top of the show.
The acceleration and the falling apart.
Exactly. We are pushing the boundaries of intelligence, building AI models that act as a highly capable second brain, even as that reliance causes our own working memory to atrophy.
Right.
But at the exact same time, we're realizing that the foundational tech infrastructure we've built, it's just fragile. It's riddled with buffer overflows and kernel vulnerabilities, and it's so invasive that individuals and entire nations are aggressively pulling back.
Building those walls.
We are trying to reach the stars with artificial intelligence while simultaneously having to rip microchips out of our car dashboards just to get a moment of privacy.
We have the sleek machine and the chaotic engine operating at the exact same time, which leaves me with one final thought for you to mull over. We just talked about AI handling our complex, multi-step thinking and developers surgically removing modems from their vehicles. It makes you wonder, if our tools keep getting smarter and true privacy requires physically disconnecting them, are we rapidly approaching a future where dumb, completely disconnected technology actually becomes the ultimate luxury status symbol?
That is a really fascinating shift in perspective.
Yeah.
Like, not being connected is the flex.
Exactly. Something to think about the next time you look at a smart device that promises to connect your entire life to the cloud. Thank you so much for joining us to explore these sources today. Keep your software patched, maybe learn how the Rust compiler works, and we'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.